The floor is now open for short, good questions. So will you please come up here and make use of the microphone? If there isn't one at the moment, let me start it off then. Bryson, let me ask you, you were talking about change of life patterns, and changing all the time. What drives this change?
There are a lot of processes involved in driving the process of evolution, but of course the most famous one, and we think in many respects perhaps the most important one, although it depends on how you measure it, is what's called natural selection, which was Darwin's great idea. It was the realization that just as when we're raising animals for food or other domestic purposes or raising crop plants, we carefully select, and today very systematically and with foreknowledge of genetics and stuff like that as well, we carefully select plants and animals with promising traits to breed, and we select out plants and animals with traits that we don't have, that we don't want, and we take them out of the breeding pool, cull them. And what Darwin saw was that this happens in nature as well. Every population, every biological population, has the capacity to out-reproduce the means of its existence. You think about just a little package of yeast that you drop in a vat of must for winemaking, right? It doesn't take very long for that little package of yeast to turn into so much yeast that it's eaten up all the sugar, and the yeast plants begin to die off. And the same goes for any natural population. And natural populations have the capacity to reproduce exponentially, and no resources can keep up with that in the long run. So Darwin said, there's going to be a struggle for existence in nature, just as there's a kind of deliberate selection of some plants and animals for breeding when we breed plants and animals. And he said, that's going to change the species over time, because if these traits are inherited, and they make a difference in a particular organism's ability to successfully survive and reproduce, then they'll tend to be present in the offspring as well, and those offspring will tend to do better than the competition in the rest of the population. And over time, pretty soon, the population will be descended only from organisms that acquired that trait. A new trait will now be universal in the population. And once that trait's there, changes in that trait and changes in other traits can be selected again as they come along and provide some kind of advantage. So that's the process of natural selection. Darwin came up with it after reading Malthus and thinking about evolution, which he already believed in at that point. This is about 1837. And Alfred Russel Wallace came up with it independently in 1858. And then they presented their work. Darwin kept his work quiet for quite a long time because he knew how controversial his ideas were going to be. And he was a cautious, careful kind of guy. But in the end, when he published the book, it didn't take long for the whole community of biologists, about 10 years, for biologists in general to accept evolution. It was a lot longer before natural selection was widely accepted as the main mechanism of evolution.
Hi, my name is Knut Peterson. I'd like to ask you, Bryson, where does cloning and genetically modified seeds and all that kind of stuff play into evolution?
I guess I'd say that's an extension of what we call artificial selection. From a kind of external point of view, it's part of the process of evolution that's happening on the planet today, but in this case it's happening due to, you know, deliberate interference on the part of one bunch of organisms in the planet, namely us, with some of the other organisms in the planet. You didn't ask about the ethical issues, which is mainly what comes up when we raise that question. I'm not terribly frightened of the potential risks involved with genetically modified organisms, even in the food chain, because I know, for instance, that in raising new species or new breeds of plants, it's not been unusual to use radiation to try and induce more variation in the plants generation over generation and then select for new traits that arise from that process. And what that does to the genome of the plants is, I think, at least comparable in terms of producing new proteins and new other kinds of biological activity in these plants to what's happening when we're deliberately selecting a gene like, say, the BT gene for corn crops or other crops that are affected by those kinds of grubs. So I'm not that worried about GM as an ethical issue right now. Not that we shouldn't observe and regulate and have standards and so on, but just that it's not a danger out of proportion to the other risks that we already run as a matter of course with the food system.
Bob Anderson. Bryson, partly as a transition to next week, the presentation that you made is reasonable, logical, the string that runs down through descent and all that. Pretty hard not to understand that and to find it reasonable and acceptable. What is it in evolution that strikes fear in the heart of so many people? What's your explanation of why my idea is that it's rejected largely because there's some fear mixed up in it? Do you agree with that? And what is it that is the fearful part?
I think there are a lot of things involved in the phenomenon that we see of so-called scientific creationism and other forms of rejection of science like intelligent design. But I think fear is one of them. I think that's right. Here's one way to put it. Darwin found his view of life exceedingly bleak. He had been, as a student, very impressed with William Paley's work on design and adaptation in biology. Paley used the argument from design to infer that just as, you know, the kinds of complicated apparatus that we have on that table were clearly designed by human beings to achieve certain purposes, Paley thought that there was enough analogy between those structures and their complexity and how they work together, how they function, and organisms to say that there had to be a designer who was responsible for organisms as well. And this went with a fairly sunny attitude towards what goes on in nature. There was a tendency to think that, you know, to speak in terms of metaphors like the balance of nature, which you still hear today, to speak in terms of you know, predation involving the selection of the weak and the unfit, right? So that predation actually looks like a kind of kindness to the poor animals that are preyed upon. And similarly, to take a kind of optimistic view broadly, a sunny view broadly of what's going on in biology. And Darwin found that he was quite unable to reconcile the idea of a beneficent, benevolent creator with the fact that cats very naturally tend to play with mice, and that various insects turn their larvae into parasites inside of other insects as part of their reproductive cycle, and so on and so forth. I mean, there are, as Darwin said, immense numbers of cruelties in nature. Whole populations die of starvation when there are droughts, and diseases ravage populations or groups regularly when they get into one member of the group and there it's a social group and the disease spreads through the whole group and wipes them out. This kind of thing is going on all the time in nature. It's part of the picture that you get when you see the world through the lens of natural selection. And it's not the kind of world we'd like our children to be subject to, that's for sure. So I think that's one of the fears. And it's true, actually, of Gish and Morris in particular. They say, look, if the world's been around for 3.5 billion years with life on it, all that time, growing, dying, preying on each other, suffering diseases, so on and so forth, they say, that's just monstrous. It can't be like that. They'd much rather believe in a 6,000-year-old world created, you know, with the Garden of Eden, where even tyrannosaurs ate, I don't know, coconuts.
Dr. Terry Shillington, thank you very much for your presentation. I quite appreciate it, and it certainly stretched my vocabulary a bit. I'm also transitioning to next week's discussion, and I'm interested in a little bit of the history around Charles Darwin, and it's a two-layered question, but the comment was made at our table that Charles Darwin renounced his own theory before the end of his life, and I'm wondering about that, and secondly, whether Darwin experienced much persecution from the church in the course of working this out.
No and no. That's the short answer. First story, that's the Lady Hope story. It was put about by a woman who was very religious and did know Darwin. There's no evidence from anybody else, including anyone in Darwin's family, of anything of the kind happening. So it sounds to me like a religiously motivated fraud. And that's the general view of historians that have actually studied the matter in some detail. Well, we have huge amounts of correspondence from Darwin and from his family, including that period. So there's no evidence for that. Sorry, I'm losing the...
The question was whether he'd experienced much persecution.
Oh, persecution. There certainly was a lot of negative reaction. The Catholic Church reacted very negatively. And Bishop Wilberforce famously reacted very negatively. He got, you know, quite a lot of criticism from scientists as well. Richard Owen was positively sarcastic and venomous, which was characteristic of Owen, about his theory of evolution. Owen more or less said, well, you know, I thought of it, but I had better taste than to go there, among other things, and made some very unfair criticisms. But the religious thing was not a particularly huge concern for Darwin. I think it was a sensitive issue in his family. He was concerned about his wife's feelings, and she was quite religious. And he himself had been religious. He'd thought of joining the ministry as a young man. And he finished as some kind of agnostic / atheist. But no, there wasn't really that much. The really vigorous religious opposition to evolution, the organized religious opposition to evolution, is a 20th century, largely American phenomenon. Yeah.
My name is Van Christou. Thank you very much, Dr. Brown, for trying and doing so successful a job at summarizing that amount of material in half an hour. You mentioned the matter of the yeast, and you put it into a mix of sugar or any carbohydrate, and it just goes like crazy until finally the food runs out. Are we not in a very similar situation in the world today with Homo sapiens, where our population is expanding at a phenomenal rate, and the Earth's resources are not increasing at the same rate at all? And the other comment that came up at our table was, isn't it interesting that what you have been talking about today is such a recent phenomenon in our human history? It's only a couple of hundred years old or so, compared with maybe 3 or 4 times the length of that our economic system was established, and that our economic system is really driving where we're going today. The question I want to ask you is, do you think that there's any hope that knowledge will prevail here and that we'll be able to change our attitudes about the distribution of wealth of this world so that we can try at least to prevent the yeast from dying out when it runs out of sugar?
I've been thinking about this quite a bit, actually. And I guess the answer that I suspect to be true right now is no. We're at about peak oil production right now by various measures. The peak of actual crude oil production goes back to May 2005. And with oil prices at record levels, it still hasn't moved from there. The notion that the Saudis have huge reserves of petroleum, huge production reserves that they could put into the market at any time, seems unsupported. And there's been some fairly serious fact-based attempts to examine what extra reserves the Saudis might really have, and it really doesn't look like they can pump that much more. That's in dispute. But certainly we can't pump 50% more than we pump today. At the same time, of course, as we begin to pursue non-standard forms of oil that require expenditures of huge amounts of energy just to get the oil out of the ground, like our tar sands here in Alberta, we are changing the climate on the earth. And there are, of course, plenty of skeptics out there who will tell you otherwise, but they aren't climate scientists, interestingly. And we do understand pretty well how carbon dioxide works in the atmosphere to affect the temperature level, the level in the atmosphere at which the Earth actually manages to radiate to space. And as we change that level and actually drive it higher up into the atmosphere with higher concentrations of CO2 and consequently higher temperatures and higher water content, which is driven by temperature, where we are clearly changing the climate. And I don't see, with China's development and the amount of they're doubling their power output every 10 years now, and they're still putting in coal plants. They're trying to develop nuclear as well, but they're putting in coal plants, and they're expecting by 2050 it'll still be two-thirds coal. They already produce more CO2 than any other country in the world, and they're only increasing, and India's only increasing. And in a sense, I don't think we're in a position to say that they shouldn't be increasing, because we've been the ones that have filled the atmosphere with CO2 up to now, much to our benefit. And they basically can say to us, look, it's our turn. And our populations, our people deserve access to similar services and resources and well-being, levels of well-being that we experience here. So I don't think we can stop them. I don't think they will stop. And I don't think our climate will be in good shape 50 years from now or 100 years from now. And our energy issues will also be a very big issue. So, yeah, we're not in good shape.
I'd just like to make a comment here. At first, the question didn't seem to be related to evolution, but it truly is. It truly is.
My name is Graham Greenlee. Bryson, we can follow evolution from millions of years ago down through the ages and the branches of the tree to the present. Trace it. Can we trace it from the present back to the beginning? In other words, what is the origin of life on Earth? We talk about Earth being 3.5 billion years old. Was there life on Earth in the beginning?
It's a separate issue from evolution. Evolution is about change in life over time. So it takes life for granted as a starting point. Darwin put it rather gracefully. He talked about there's a kind of grandeur in this view of life. This is the closing lines of The Origin, in which life was originally perhaps breathed by the Creator into some form or forms and has since filled the earth and its crust with its ever-branching ramifications, something like that. It's a rough paraphrase. So it's not really a question about evolution, but it's obviously a related question. There has been quite a bit of work done, of course, but it's a small field. It's not a field that's of much practical importance, so you don't get corporate funding for doing this kind of research. But there are quite a few people, going back to the Miller experiments, where we can show that certain kinds of organic molecules can be produced quite easily under the kinds of conditions that we think obtained on the surface of the Earth. We're talking about on the order of 4 billion years, just at the end of the Hadean. We call that the first period of the Earth's existence the Hadean because it's a time during which multiple monstrous impacts were still striking the planet on a regular basis, and most of the surface was molten, and, you know, Hadean seems like a good word for it. At any rate, shortly after that, the atmosphere is very different from the atmosphere we have today. The atmosphere we have today is a product of life. And the chemistry of that atmosphere, as best we can tell, was such as to allow organic molecules to be fairly easily made and produced in various places, in the atmosphere, through electrical discharges, in the seas, possibly near hot springs under the ocean beds and under the ocean and so on. How it goes from there, it's a very complicated story. There are lots of theories and lots of ideas that have been worked on, including ideas about an RNA world where RNA actually did all the biological work early on. And at some point in the history of life, that might well be true. Some of the key biological molecules are still, or key processes are still driven by RNA when you get right down to the bottom of the chemistry. We have some idea of how this might have happened. We certainly have no evidence to say that it couldn't have happened. So it could have happened naturalistically. Life could have floated in from outer space, too, for all we know. That's a view that goes back some time. People have suggested that many times before. And, of course, it could have been created by a god who was running some kind of interesting experiment on the surface here.
I think you put it well when you said you don't know how it happened. I have a book here written by a fellow that used to be an evolutionist and is a creationist today. And he says both evolution and creationism are faith-based. Science has never ultimately proved evolution. That's what this fellow says, who now is a creationist and was an evolutionist. It has not been proven. Evolution has not been proven. Both of them are faith-based. We can't understand the beauty of the sun, the stars, the moon. We know there's harmony in there. And so, for my part, I think there's much evidence that there's a supreme being somewhere. And a great man in the United States many years ago said, and I think this is true, he says, all men know there is a supreme being somewhere, and all men know they are responsible to that supreme being. And I believe that supreme being created heaven and earth. Don't you think so?
Can I have a look at that? I'll tell you. This guy's new to me. Well, I'll ask your pardon, but please don't try to tell me what I know. Please don't try to tell me that. Please don't try to tell me what I know. I don't know that there is a supreme being. I've been thinking about these things for a long time. Ah, yes, that's easy to say. Yeah, I think you know better than your creationism too, then. Thanks.
Before you die, you'll know.
My name is Georgie Harper. Thank you for an excellent speech. Most enjoyable, lots to think about. You alluded to the idea of Darwin having a problem toward the end of his life. I want to know, because many of my friends are in the science field and they're definitely evolutionists, does that mean they're atheist or agnostic? And if so, where does this all come from?
First off, it clearly doesn't mean that they're atheist or agnostic. There are plenty of scientists, biologists. Ken Miller is a good example, is a moderate.
Can you repeat the question?
The question is, lady has quite a number of friends who are into the sciences, who work in the sciences, who are biologists, who believe in evolution. And she asked, are they therefore atheists or agnostics? And the answer is no. It doesn't follow that they're atheists or agnostics. They may be, but that's a separate thing. Ken Miller is a prominent biologist, a fellow who testified against intelligent design in the Dover trial recently. And he's a theist. And the Pope, John Paul II, the last Pope, said that evolution, when it comes to the physical development of life on Earth, is more than a theory. Something established on the evidence. That's a change in the view of the Catholic Church over a fairly short period, because the initial response from the Pope, whose name I can't recall right now, to Darwin's theories was, well, shall we say, dismissive, and even hostile. So there are plenty of religious people in the world today who reconcile without any trouble the idea of evolution and even the idea of a natural origin of life on Earth with belief in a God. It takes some kind of special attachment to the story told in Genesis, or I should say stories, because there are two conflicting creation stories in Genesis. They don't really jive well together, and on textual grounds, they're believed to actually be originally separate stories that sort of got amalgamated into what's now the book of Genesis. You have to be attached to those as if they were intended as some kind of natural description of the history of the earth rather than as a kind of founding myth for a Middle Eastern people. And not all religious people are that attached to the literal truth of these kinds of mythical tales, whether it's Genesis or Jonah and the whale or what have you. There are other points for those people that are made religiously by these stories, points that are quite distinct from the natural history of the earth.
For the last question, unless there's an urgent one thereafter.
There's probably 65 urgent questions out there, plus. Thank you very much for your address. It's a rich, rich thing that you were giving us today, and the more we can learn about our natural world, the better for us. Thank you very much. I have a question to you around natural evils or natural biological evolution. And that has to do with the phenomenon of human evil. And how can that so very troubling, which affects the conscience of many in our country who see that, why is it that we enumerate the number of people, of our soldiers or American soldiers who are killed, but we don't list or have very much concern about the natives of Afghanistan or Iraq? Is that a form of natural selection? I'm not really sure. The second question has to do, is it where do you think there's conversation between you and the theists? Where is there a place for conversation? It might be a bit preferable to have that than for us equally trying to find ways to burn each other.
I don't think evolutionists have any tradition of burnings. The problem of evil is certainly a problem from a human moral point of view, and certainly from the point of view of various religions, which try to offer perhaps ways of thinking that might moderate our behavior. Not that I find religions are that successful at it. Not that I find that anything we've done has been terribly successful at getting people to behave well towards each other. I certainly agree that the fact that we see the loss of one of our own as significant and dismiss the loss of thousands of people of other nations is both something that distorts our policy making and reflects very badly on us morally. That said, grounds for contact between theists and evolutionists. The two, I think, as activities are largely disjoint. What evolutionists are interested in doing is studying biology and understanding the world, the natural world as we find it, when we observe it, when we look and compare different organisms, when we study their history in the fossil record, and so on and so forth. Theists are concerned with, shall we say, larger things and less obvious things. A supreme being is not something that, you know, you can just point to the way you can point to, I don't know, a dragonfly or an oak tree. So if we're going to have a conversation, it's probably going to be about whether there's any shared ground on the question of how we justify beliefs, and if there's any agreement that we can reach about how, on the one hand, science can go about its business of trying to understand the world, without necessarily offending those who have religious beliefs that they also find important. But if they're going to take offense when a biologist or a geologist says, look, the world is about 4.6 billion years old, life has been on the Earth since about, well, possibly as much as 3.8 billion years ago, certainly 3.5 when we actually see microfossils, so on and so forth. If that's considered offensive to religious belief, then I think those religious beliefs are actually occupying a piece of turf that really is about natural understanding of the natural world that's got to be grounded in the kinds of observations that individual human beings can make regardless of their religious beliefs. And that's what we do in science. And if we can agree on
some sort of division of turf, then I think some form of fideist religious faith is still defensible.
Yeah. Well, I think we had an outstanding session. I really do think so. In the true history of SACPA, I thank the very, very good questionnaires with their concise and short questions. That was wonderful. But, Bryson, you amaze me. You are, the amount of information you have at your fingertips is just incredible. Now, I have a lot of information, too, but I take hours to find it in my files at home, you know. But he's got it right there, and he just puts it right there together. He's just...
Years of lecturing.
Oh, well, I will never catch up. Bryson, thank you so much for such an exciting time. Thank you. Thank you. Aren't we lucky to have him in Lethbridge? Isn't that wonderful? Oh.